Well, as it's getting set up here, let me say that I can hardly believe how well I've been treated. Normally, at many venues that I go to, I'm not necessarily treated that well. So I went to the hotel here and had this beautiful suite, and I thought, are you sure this is for the right person? So thank you so much for that. It's really a pleasure to be here. And to get a chance to meet so many people with whom I've followed their work and received encouragement from. To meet Dr. Moeller, meet John Piper on the bus coming over here, I'm thinking, wow, this is great. I need to orbit around these circles a little more frequently. This is nourishing to my soul in many respects. Don Carson, too, looking forward to our interview later. Thank you for making me feel welcome. Now let's get to the matter at hand, the issue of homosexuality and the Bible. Start at the beginning in creation, of course, because that's where Jesus starts us. When he deals with the issue of sex, the two major sex texts about Jesus in Mark 10, parallel to Matthew 19, Jesus himself takes us back to Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. So, of course, that's where we will start. You, of course, are familiar with these texts. Genesis 1:27, God created the Adam, the human, in his image. In the image of God, he created it or him. Male and female, he created them. What we can see in this text is a close correspondence between being made in God's image and male-female complementarity. The implication of it is that sexual activity can either enhance or threaten to efface that image that's stamped in our being. Male and female are indicated here as angled expressions, if you will, of God's image, part of a two-faceted sexual whole. Procreation is perceived here in this context as merely one dimension of that complementarity. The complementarity ranges anatomically, physiologically, and even psychologically. There is in the text attention to structural congruity or kinds. Animals too, as you note, are created as male and female, but a key difference exists here. Namely, their male-female gender is not integrated into their status as those made in God's image. We have a lovely dog, Benji, whose part is actually a Morkie, part Yorkshire Terrier, part Maltese. We love Benji, but I don't derive my sexual ethics from Benji because Benji is not very discriminating when it comes to sexual ethics. But that's okay. God doesn't hold Benji accountable. Benji is not made in God's image. We are. And what we do sexually affects that. There is stress in the context on compatibility. Incidentally, in the Genesis text, Genesis 1, not male dominance. I say that because a misogyny argument is sometimes put forward that we'll deal with later. Genesis 2, creation of woman. Yahweh God said, it's not good for the Adam to be alone. I will make for him a helper as his counterpart. As you know, animals are brought before him. He names them. But for the Adam, the human, there was not found a helper as his counterpart. And Yahweh God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the Adam, the human. And he slept. And he took one of his sides. I'm rendering here side as opposed to ribs for the Hebrew term salah for reasons we'll see in a moment. And he closed up its place with flesh. And Yahweh God built the salah or side that he had taken from the Adam into a woman and brought her to the Adam. And the Adam or human said, this at last is bone for my bones and flesh for my flesh. To this one shall be given the name woman, Isha. For from man, here a gender-specific term as opposed to Adam, Ish, this one was taken. Therefore, an Ish, a man, shall leave his father and mother and become attached. Now, this is the same Hebrew word, and also there's the corresponding Greek word where this also applies in the Septuagint. These terms are used to apply also to gluing things together. Although I don't want you to draw the conclusion from this when you go back to your spouse, say, honey, I just found out today that I'm stuck with you. No, not prepositions are sometimes very important. Not stuck with you, stuck to you. or joined, were united to his woman or wife, and they, or the two, shall become one flesh. The two appears only in the virginal, that is non-Hebrew evidence, everywhere, in the Samaritan Pentateuch, in the Aramaic Targums, in the Septuagint, in the Vulgate. Does not appear, however, in the Masoretic text. But it's a very early interpretation of what is meant by the they, which Jesus himself picks up on, shall become one flesh. Now, the meaning of that term salah that's used for rib, if you look at the massive theological dictionary of the Old Testament, there's an entry by Hans Josef Fabry on this word Selah, in which he says, if Selah does mean rib in Genesis 2, it does so only in this one passage. And I add parenthetically, not in the 36 other occurrences of the term. This semantic singularity, of course, suggests that one should seek a different solution, which is what I do here. In 2 Samuel 16, it refers to the side of a hill. Everywhere else in the Hebrew Bible, it refers to the side of a piece of sacral architecture. Whether this is the side of the ark, tabernacle, or incense altar in Exodus, or the side planks or side rooms of the Solomonic temple, according to 1 Kings, or of the eschatological temple in Ezekiel. In other words, human sexuality is being presented here as sacral architecture. This is also brought out at a much later date by Paul in 1 Corinthians 6, in which he says that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit that is in you, and that you are bought with a price, and therefore you do not belong to yourselves anymore. And the whole context is about sexual ethics. Now, we can compare this picture to first century and thereafter writers that look at the Genesis 2 text. For example, Philo of Alexandria says, love brings together and fits into one the divided halves, as it were, into a single living creature. And which side did God take? For we may assume that only two are indicated. Did he take the left or the right side? That's his interpretation of the term Selah. Plura in Greek. Or compare Genesis Rabbah 8:1, rabbinic text. Rabbi Samuel Bar Nachman said, when God created Adam, he created him double-faced. Then he split him and made him two backs, one back on this side and one back on the other side. Selah means one of his sides, as you read, and for the other side of the tabernacle. Now, they differ as to whether we're talking about left or right, front or back. Doesn't really make any difference to me. The point is two sides of an integrated sexual whole. Then there's the term konegdo that's used in the Hebrew text to find for the Adam or human a helper as his counterpart, konegdo. It's from the terms ka, preposition as or like, the suffix o meaning his, and neged, which means both similarity corresponding to, similarity as far as being a fellow human being, and difference. Same term used for both elements, incidentally. Here are the differences opposite, namely as regards distinct sex extracted from him. It's a perfect term for a counterpart or a complement. There's a strong emphasis in the Genesis 2 text on something being extracted or taken from the Adam. In fact, a fourfold reference in 2:21 to 23 to forming a woman by taking from the human a part of him, so that there is thus a missing element then in that human, which can only be restored by the union of the two into one. God took one of, or literally from, his sides, or ribs. Yahweh God built the sides of Selah that he had taken from the Adam. This is bone from my bones, flesh from my flesh. And finally, this one is given the name Isha, woman, for from the Ish, or man, this one was taken. There's a reason why that fourfold emphasis of an extraction of some, of an element being taken from the human. What is missing from the Adam, now designated an Ish, a gender-specific man, is the part that God builds into the woman. In the context, then, one flesh implies a restoring of that missing element to an indivisible whole. Man and woman are thus viewed as two essential complementary parts in a holistic picture of human sexuality, The implications are obvious. Another man then cannot fill the missing part. It requires here a sexual complement or counterpart to this one. One flesh then does not mean merely of the same family. It means a restoration of the sexual whole. So in effect here, the image of one flesh becoming two sexes grounds the principle of two sexes becoming one flesh. Marriage is then viewed as a reconstitution of the divided parts, not merely a union, but a reunion. Same-sex erotic unions would, of course, then be precluded structurally, simply because you're not bringing together the two halves of the sexual whole. Homoerotic unions would require a different kind of creation story, the kind, for example, that we find told by Aristophanes in Plato's Symposium, where an original binary man-man and woman-woman and man-woman are each then split by Zeus, who gets angry with them, and thereafter you long for that part from which you most hailed from. Moreover, there's no element of misogyny here. There's clearly a great joy of rejoining with one's sexual other half. Of course, I wouldn't recommend using that precise nomenclature on your wedding night, but you know what I'm talking about here. In fact, Genesis 3:16 attributes a husband's rule to the fall. Genesis 2:21-24 stresses only sameness? I would argue not. Again, the idea of a woman being taken from the original human is important when you set it in its historical context. For example, in the Mesopotamian story of the creation of the woman in Atrahasis, seven human males and seven human females are formed separately from a mixture of clay and the flesh blood of a slaughtered god. One is not extracted from the other. That sort of two halves of an integrated sexual whole comes across only in the Genesis text in the ancient Near East. There are also several texts from early Judaism that emphasize the point that a woman is part of a man. For example, in 4 Maccabees, the mother of the seven sons about to be slaughtered declares, "I was a pure virgin and guarded the side or rib," depending how you render the Greek noun plura, which can mean either, just as the Hebrew selah can mean either. By the way, when Jesus talks about his hands that receive a mark from the crucifixion, it talks about his side, that term is plura. She had guarded the side that had been built up from the man. Or in the apocalypse of Moses, Eve asked Adam to kill her so that God and his angels would no longer be angry with him. And Adam responds, "Why should I bring death to my side against the image that God made?" And then Eve's death is portrayed as a time when Adam's side or rib would return to him. Here's a picture of male-female differences. I received permission from my wife to put this up. She explained to me the correct meaning, which is that men are very simplistic creatures and women are very complicated. It's actually the physiological evidence for that. I was talking to somebody here, Miguel, from Dominican Republic, who's a doctor, who was telling me about brain differences between men and women, which will now justify to my wife my inability to multitask. Okay, on to Jesus, the witness of Jesus. This is a question of the silence of the Lamb. Little cinematic echo there. Actually, there isn't a silence here. Jesus speaks quite powerfully about a male-female requirement for sexual ethics. Again, the key Jesus sex text in Mark 10 with a parallel in Matthew 19. And when the Pharisees approached, they were asking him if it was permissible for a man to divorce his wife, etc. Jesus said to them, "With a view to your hardness of heart, he wrote to you this command. But from the beginning of creation, male and female, he made them." Incidentally, that's an interesting point about sexual ethics and Jesus' interpretation of Scripture, because that indicates that there are some texts in the Old Testament that don't represent God's perfect will. There was an allowance made because of human, chiefly male, hardness of heart. And a permission or license was given men that was never given women. Women were never allowed multiple male partners. A man could with polygamy, or more specifically, polygyny. But Jesus revokes that loophole in the Mosaic law on the basis of God's creation will, which also, incidentally, says something significant about how Jesus understood his own authority. and status. He thought he could unilaterally amend the Constitution of Israel given by God to Moses at Sinai. There's no precedent for that anywhere in early Judaism. Anywhere. And then he cites the two famous texts from Genesis 1:27 and 2:24. From the beginning of creation, quote, male and female, he made them. And then for this reason, as if to say, given Genesis 1:27, a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What then God has yoked together, let no man separate. And then further statements about that implication for divorce and remarriage, which sometime we could talk about but don't have time today. Basically, to summarize, Jesus took the most difficult occasions in which divorce may arise, when a woman, for example, is unjustly divorced by her husband and pronounced that if she remarries, she commits adultery, and if any man marries her, they commit adultery. That man commits adultery, irrespective of the fact that she is without fault, at least so far as concerns justification of the divorce. So you can go to my website and see more discussion about that and my interaction with David Instone Brewer of the argument. The evangelical church has conceded too much in this issue that the church fathers themselves never conceded. But that's another issue. I'm in enough trouble as it is. Let's move on to this one. Jesus clearly declares here that Genesis 1:27 and 2:24 are normative and prescriptive, with proscriptive implications for all matters of human sexual ethics. That marriage is an institution designed, ordained by God, by the Creator, between one man and one woman in a lifelong, indissoluble union that human beings do not have the right to alter. That is the foundation of human sexuality. Jesus emphasized here in the context the two-ness of the sexual bond, thereby prohibiting a revolving door of divorce and remarriage and implicitly polygamy, or more specifically, polygyny. The question is, where does Jesus get this fixation on the number two? What is the one point shared in common between the two verses, Genesis 1:27 and 2:24? There's not a lot he cites from Genesis 1:27, only one-third of the entire verse. It's the fact of a male and female, or man and woman. In other words, the two-ness of the sexes is the foundation for the two-ness of the sexual bond. Third parties are then neither necessary nor desirable, because once you join together the only two halves of the sexual spectrum, male and female, a third party becomes neither necessary nor desirable. Incidentally, we have confirmation for this from the Essenes, a rigorous group, sectarian group within early Judaism that was so rigorous in their observance of the Mosaic Law that they regarded the Pharisees as wimps when it came to observing the Mosaic Law, which would give you a totally different picture from what you get from the Gospels, where they're viewed as too stringent. In the Essenes' view, they're too lax. And yet the Essenes take this posture with regard to the question of the number of partners in a sexual union. They noted, taking two wives in their lives is to be rejected because, quote, the foundation of creation is male and female, he created them. Citing the same one-third of Genesis 1:27 that Jesus would cite a century and a half later. And because, quote, those who entered Noah's Ark went in two by two. Incidentally, you might think the phrase male and female occurs all over the place in the Hebrew Bible. It doesn't. The phrase zakah una keva actually occurs elsewhere only in Genesis 5, 1-2, introducing the genealogy and restating Genesis 1:27, and otherwise only in the Noah's Ark narratives, where it's glossed with the phrase two by two. And in effect, the Essenes are saying, look, it's clear there's a sort of self-contained two-ness to the sexual bond, given the number of sexes that God creates for pairing. Again, the two-ness of the sexes is the basis for the two-ness of the sexual bond. What that implies is that homosexual relationships are worse than polygamous ones, because polygamous relationships are rejected on the basis of a foundation of a male-female requirement. The two-ness of the sexes becomes the basis of limiting the number of partners in a sexual union to two, whether at any one time or serially. So if you reject the foundation of a prerequisite of a male-female bond, you're doing precisely that, rejecting a foundation on which the limitation of the number of partners in a sexual union is extrapolated. And this is verified by the Old Testament's view of polygamy in relationship to homosexual practice. As you know, there's a series of concessions for male polygamy in the Hebrew Bible, subsequently revoked by Jesus in the New Covenant dispensation. There's never any permission given for homosexual practice in the Hebrew Bible. Every text, every narrative, every law, every proverb, every piece of poetry that has anything to do with sexual ethics always presupposes a male-female requirement without exception. And then if we had time, we could go into further evidence of Jesus' rejection, of why we know Jesus would have rejected homosexual practice and maintained a male-female requirement to sexual unions, but we don't have time to do that right now. Let's move on to Paul, Paul's witness. Therefore, God gave them over, Romans 1:24 to 1:27, because of the desires of their hearts, to an uncleanness or sexual impurity, akathisia is the term in Greek, consisting of their bodies being dishonored among themselves, the very one, mind you, who exchanged the truth about God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Because of this, God gave them over to dishonorable passions. Even their females exchanged the natural use, i.e. of the male as regards sexual intercourse, for that which is contrary to nature, and likewise also the males, having left behind the natural use of the female, i.e. as regards sexual intercourse, were inflamed with their yearning for one another, males with males, committing indecency, and in return receiving in themselves the payback necessitated by their straying from God. Three main arguments are used to discount the biblical witness here: the exploitation argument, the orientation argument, and the misogyny argument. The exploitation argument, which coalesces with a promiscuity argument, basically argues that Paul only knew about exploitative and promiscuous forms of homosexual practice, and had he known about lifelong committed homosexual unions, he might have changed his view. Or the orientation argument, that had he been aware of the concept of some sort of innate influence on homosexual attraction, he might have changed his view, but he didn't know it. Or the misogyny argument, that Paul simply feared homosexual practice because it upset hierarchical dominance of men over women. The plot structure of Romans 1:18 and 32, just to lay out the context here. Stage one, God's power in divinity is visibly manifested in creation. It's obvious, it's transparent in the material structures of creation, such that Paul is making the case not merely that all human beings sin, duh, that's an easy point, but rather that all human beings are culpable for the sin that they commit because they sin against the knowledge of the truth accessible to them. Stage two, humans then suppress that truth and foolishly exchange the true God for idols. Stage three, God's wrath is then manifested, not in God actively intervening, but actually the opposite. God simply steps back and allows human beings to be controlled by their self-dishonoring, self-degrading urges, which mar the image of God stamped on their being. In other words, they get what they want. By the way, the implication of that would be God's grace would be something the exact opposite. Namely, God steps back in to the picture to prevent us from engaging in self-dishonoring, self-degrading activity. That's what grace is, not merely forgiveness, but transformation of the inner self through the gift of the Spirit. And then humans even exchange natural intercourse for unnatural intercourse, all committed some forms of improper act. Romans 1:18 and 32 is simply an extended vice list, which begins with idolatry and sexual immorality, highlighting same-sex sexual immorality as a paradigmatic example, because it's such a clear example of suppressing the truth about God accessible in material structures, i.e. our bodies. These sinful deeds then merit death. In other words, God's cataclysmic judgment on the day of the Lord. Now, there are strong intertextual echoes here to Genesis 1:26 to 1:27. Paul doesn't have to cite the text. Burgeoning industry in New Testament study to point out allusions or echoes to Old Testament texts without having to give citations. This is a classic example of such a case. Clear references to creation and the Creator in 1:20 and 1:25, and Romans 1:23 clearly echoes Genesis 1:26. Romans 1:23 says that humans exchanged the glory of the imperishable God for the likeness of the image of a perishable human and of birds and four-footed animals and of reptiles. Genesis 1:26 says, "Let us make a human according to our image and likeness, and let them rule over the birds, the cattle, and the reptiles." 6 points of correspondence between one verse each. That's a pretty clear indication of an intertextual echo. Romans 1:26 to 1:27 that then follows clearly echoes Genesis 1:27. Why does 1:26, 1:27 of Romans restrict, why does Paul restrict himself to the nomenclature of males and females as opposed to saying, for example, man and woman? Because the very next text in Genesis is male and female, he made them. So if you look at it in chart form, you see a tripartite structure here of God's likeness and image in humans, part A, part B, dominion over the animal kingdom, followed by male-female differentiation. This is a pretty clear echo of the Genesis creation text. What is the point of these echoes? Idolatry and same-sex intercourse together constitute a frontal assault on the work of the Creator in nature. Instead of recognizing their creation in God's image and their dominion over the animals, they blurred that by engaging in sex with members of the same sex. Actually, in the first one, I should say, blurred it by worshiping idols in the image of humans and even animals. And instead of acknowledging that God had made them male and female, something that should be transparently obvious to them, they ignored that by engaging in sex with members of the same sex. In short, those who had suppressed the truth about God visible in creation went on to suppress the truth about themselves visible in nature. So in effect, the scripture argument is at the same time a nature argument. So Gentiles who don't have access to the book of Genesis and Leviticus and other texts in front of them are without excuse. But at the same time, those who have access to the direct revelation of God are doubly without excuse. As far as the nature argument goes, it's clear in the context. The truth about God is visible and apparent in material creation, says Paul in 1:19-20. Namely, the knowable aspect of God is visible or apparent to them because God has made it visible or apparent to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible qualities are clearly seen, being mentally apprehended by means of the things made. I've actually had some person supporting homosexual practice in the PCUSA saying, well, that's a very unreformed view. And yet when you read Calvin on Romans 1, Calvin said, here's a nature argument. And what Calvin argues is that you can't know enough from nature to be saved, but you can know enough from nature to be condemned. That's a very reformed view, and you see that also in the Confessions of the Book of Confessions in the PCUSA. Likewise, the truth about God's will for sex is visible in our gendered bodies. This is why Paul picks up, among all sexual offenses, he picks up same-sex practice as a parallel illustration on the horizontal level for the vertical illustration of suppressing the truth about God accessible in the material structures of creation. Namely, that the proper order for sex is visible in our gendered bodies. It's obvious on the level of anatomy, physiology, psychology, that the appropriate counterpart to a man is a woman and a woman a man. And you have to deliberately suppress the truth about God to avoid that truth. Or another way of putting it is you need many, many years of education in order to ignore it. So in other words, pagans don't have to have Genesis or Leviticus in front of them to be held accountable for this knowledge. It is obvious so that they are without excuse. Some of these pictures that are coming up here are illustrations of sexual attraction between men of relatively equal age, looking into each other's eyes, indicating mutuality and reciprocity, so much for the fact that they didn't know about such things in antiquity. Sometimes a single picture is worth 1,000 words. Loving disposition and orientation are irrelevant to Paul's argument because Paul's concerned about the absence of a true gender complement. And you can't fake gender complementarity as much as you try. Innate desires are also unreliable guides as to what God's will is for human sexuality because, as you know, most of our innate urges are to do what God expressly forbids and therefore are not great indications about what the will of God is. Lesbianism is mentioned here. Sorry, the typeface is a little bit small here. Paul is arguing here from lesbianism. Why that's an important argument is because lesbianism in antiquity is not conducted in typically exploitative fashion. That is, with a adolescent or with a slave girl, but rather it tends to be conducted in adult consensual unions. So when Paul rejects lesbianism, he rejects the totality of homosexual practice. That's why some people try to say he's not talking about lesbianism, but he clearly is. If you have questions about that later, we can talk about it. Moreover, he's not indicting exploitative relationships, also made clear from his statement that he makes that males were inflamed with their yearning for one another, males with males. He's not talking about just having something done to someone in an exploitative fashion. Therefore, he cannot be thinking of coercive master-slave relationships in his remark. Moreover, the conception of a caring homoerotic union exists long before Paul and well into Paul's day. For example, in Plato's Symposium, Aristophanes remarks that they, the two men, continue with one another throughout life, desiring to join together and be fused into a single entity and to become one person from two. Some persons argue that that is simply a comic remark by Aristophanes, but it actually plays off of a positive view of homosexuality expressed also in the Symposium by Phaedrus and Pausanias. Pausanias was a lover of Agathon, a relationship that began when Agathon, now 31, was 18, so it was never typically a pederastic relationship. Pausanias emphasizes that, quote, love is neither right nor wrong in itself, but only right or wrong when it's done rightly. Sounds like a contemporary argument. And for the right reasons, that lovers who love rightly are, quote, prepared to love in the expectation that they will be with them all their life and will share with their lives in common as if having been fused into a single entity with the soul of the beloved. That hardly indicates a coercive or exploitative relationship. Moreover, other examples, two second century romances, both include tragic love stories about similar aged male lovers. First second century Rome, Martial, the epigrammatist, and Juvenal, the satirist, comment sarcastically on effeminate men who willingly commit themselves as brides to another man in semi-legal arrangements. For example, Gracchus, a man, quote, renowned for his family background and wealth, became a bride to a common cornet player and signed semi-official marriage documents. Lucian of Samosata, second century, tells of two rich women who regard themselves as married, the masculine Megilla of Lesbos, from which we get lesbianism, and her wife, Demonas the Corinthian. The astrologer Ptolemy of Alexandria, second century, refers to manly women born under a certain constellation who are lustful for sexual relations, contrary to nature, and take the active role with women whom they sometimes call their lawful wives. There are debates in the ancient world between proponents of man-male love and proponents of male-female love, in which the proponents of man-male love argue, as in this text, the Pseudo-Lucianic Affairs of the Heart, reciprocal expressions of love between a man and his male beloved reach a point where it's difficult to perceive which of the two is a lover of which, as though in a mirror. This is actually alluding to some Platonic texts, their own little intertextual echo. Why then do you reproach it when it was ordained by divine laws? Clearly, that's not an argument based on saying we're exploitative. Several rabbinic texts forbid marriage of a man to a male. One even refers to Egyptian practices forbidding marriage and forbids marriage of a woman to a woman. The late second century church father Clement of Alexandria referred to women in Alexandria who, contrary to nature, were marrying women. And yet, even though it's a committed relationship, obviously in a marital context, it's still contrary to nature. Plutarch's Dialogue on Love, which is another example of one of these debates between proponents of man-male love and proponents of male-female love, late 1st century, early 2nd century. Two proponents of man-male love argue, one, Protogenes argues that man-male love is superior to male-female love because instead of having as a net result the reaping of the fruits of pleasure, mere lust, it comes through friendship, and the end of such a man-male relationship is the goal of virtue. Pisces infers that while, quote, it's doubtless fitting for a woman acting with discretion and moderation, neither to love passionately nor to be loved passionately, it's different for a male beloved because that's an appropriate sex partner. So then how does an opponent of man-male love argue in contrast in this debate? Daphnius admits that homosexual relationships are not necessarily exploitative. For, quote, sexual intercourse that is contrary to nature with males does not do away with nor damage a lover's kindness. You see how they can distinguish the concept between contrary to nature and yet still do it in the context of a committed relationship. Yet he says, even when, quote, that intercourse that comes about from the joining of males is done willingly, it still remains shameful, since males with softness and effeminacy surrender themselves to be mounted in the custom of four-footed animals and be sowed as if to produce children contrary to nature, using a procreation argument. A gay historian, Lewis Crompton, who wrote a 500-page book called Homosexuality and Civilization, published by that homophobic press known as Harvard University Press, writes, when he talks about Paul, according to one interpretation, Paul's words were not directed at bona fide homosexuals in committed relationships. But such a reading, however well-intentioned, seems strained and unhistorical. Nowhere does Paul or any other Jewish writer of this period imply the least acceptance of same-sex relations under any circumstance. The idea that homosexuals might be redeemed by mutual devotion would have been wholly foreign to Paul or any other Jew or early Christian. In other words, he rejects the exploitation argument as a valid new knowledge argument. Same thing with Bernadette Bruton, who was one of my professors at Harvard Divinity School when I was a student there, now teaching at Brandeis. Wrote a 500-page book on lesbianism in antiquity, published by University of Chicago Press. She also argues, for example, Boswell argued that early Christian church does not appear to have opposed homosexual practice per se. The sources on female homoeroticism that I present in this book run absolutely counter to that conclusion. Moreover, if the dehumanizing aspects of pederasty motivated Paul to condemn sexual relations between males, referring to Robin Scrogg's argument, then why did he condemn relations between females in the same sentence? Romans 1:27, like the Levitical prohibitions, condemn all males in male-male relationships, regardless of age, making it unlikely that lack of mutuality or concern for the passive boy were Paul's central concerns. The ancient sources, which rarely speak of sexual relations between women and girls, undermine Scrogg's theory that Paul opposed homosexuality as pederasty. Here's a key work now that's much more recent by William Loder. He's an Australian New Testament scholar. His work, he's written about 8 or 9 books on sexuality in the ancient world and early Judaism and early Christianity. He's now become the foremost sex guy. I used to be. I bow graciously to be number 2 now on that score. I've still done more on the homosexuality issue, however. He has about 100 pages in his book on the New Testament on sexuality, on the issue of homosexuality, and I'm his chief dialogue partner. One thing that's interesting about Loder is that he concedes the point that the biblical prohibitions on homosexual practice are absolute and would take in even non-exploitative committed homosexual unions, even though Loder himself is thoroughly affirming of homosexual relations. I actually presented at the last Society of Biblical Literature meeting in, of all groups, the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer hermeneutics session. That was interesting. And I responded to Loder's work. And at the end, Loder had not a single rebuttal to anything I had to say. Not one. And I addressed his, I first of all thanked him for his agreement on the exploitation argument. For example, he notes Romans 1:26 to 27 included, but was by no means limited to exploitative pederasty. Sexual abuse of male slaves or same-sex acts performed within idolatrous ritual concerns. It was not limited to those either. It is inconceivable that Paul would approve of any same-sex acts, he argues, and then relates that also to the terms arsenokoitai and malakoi in 1 Corinthians 6:9. Arsenokoitai, by the way, men who lie with a male, is extrapolated directly from the Levitical Septuagint terms for male and lying with or having sexual intercourse with. It's a distinct Jewish-Christian formulation. And it's as every bit as absolute as the Levitical prohibitions. Oops, on the other side here. Loder's orientation, how argument, is a little less steady. He acknowledges that people in Paul's time did make observations about different sexual orientation, including lifelong orientation. He draws this from Bruton's work and my work. And then notes it's not unlikely that Paul will have had some awareness of these theories. However, they are far from the complex theories of modern times or at best rudimentary. And moreover, he argues that had Paul been aware of such theories, he would have rejected them. Well, there are many Greco-Roman theories for positing some degree of congenital influence on homoerotic attraction in the ancient world. Platonic, Aristotelian, Hippocratic, and even astrological. For example, the creation splitting of male-male or female-female binary humans presented in the symposium. Aristophanes notes that they are not inclined by nature, fousei, toward marriage and the procreation of children, yet are compelled to get married in heterosexual relationships by the law or custom, with the result that the two joined males separately, sort of like two things going on at the same time there, live out their lives with one another unmarried because culture won't allow them to marry. But by nature, they're constituted to marry one another, man with males. Other arguments, particular mix of male and female sperm elements at conception could lead to innate attractions to the same sex, a chronic disease of the mind or soul influenced indirectly by biology and made hard to resist by socialization. That's closer to our own theories. Less close are an inherited disease analogous to a mutated gene, or even further afield, sperm ducts leading to the anus for some men who want to be penetrated there, or even with astrological theories, a particular alignment of heavenly constellations at birth. The point is that there are many different theories that posit some degree of influence to homosexual attraction, not derived purely from personal choice or culture. This is noted by Thomas K. Hubbard, a classicist who wrote the definitive source book of homosexuality in Greece and Rome, published by the University of California Press, Berkeley. Quote, homosexuality in this era of the early imperial age of Rome may have ceased to be merely another practice of personal pleasure and began to be viewed as an essential and central category of personal identity, exclusive to and antithetical to heterosexual orientation. Or Bruton, the lesbian at Brandeis, New Testament scholar, Paul could have believed that trabades, active partners in female-female intercourse, or the ancient kenaidoi, passive partners in man-male intercourse, and other sexually unorthodox persons were born that way. Paul could have believed that, she said, and yet still condemn them as unnatural and shameful. I would say condemn the behavior. I believe that Paul used the word exchange to indicate that people knew the natural sexual order of the universe and left it behind. I see Paul as condemning all forms of homoeroticism as the unnatural acts of people who had turned away from God. In other words, it doesn't matter what your innate attractions are. The fact is God gives you clues in the way in which you're made that you should know what the will of God is and therefore behave in ways contrary to those innate impulses when they run against the will of God. Loder makes a faulty argument about Philo of Alexandria. He says, we know that Paul would have rejected a theory about sexual orientation because when we look at Philo, for example, it's more likely other Jews he would have rejected out of hand, as does Philo after reporting Aristophanes' bizarre etiology of human sexuality, which I've already talked about. But of course, Philo and all other Jews would not supplant the creation stories in Genesis 1 to 3 with the creation image in Aristophanes' tale in Plato's Symposium. That's obvious. That doesn't mean, however, that he rejects all biological or nurture becomes nature theories. In fact, that suggests that the latter is adopted by Philo because he speaks of boys who become accustomed to desire same-sex intercourse by habit, working in their souls a disease hard to fight against, and of men, he refers to men who are conquered by a more forcible desire for other men. So it's something that comes upon them and not something that they simply naturally choose, that they choose by choice, consensually. Loder appears to claim that idolatry is a necessary prerequisite for same-sex attractions, but that can't be true. The vice list that continues in Romans 1:28-32, which includes greed, envy, and arrogance, don't obviously come into existence when only idolatry kicks in the decline of civilization. Paul is speaking about collective entities in this chapter, not individuals, and he's talking about widespread effect, not origin. Clearly, Paul believed that self-professed Christians could become men who lie with a male, because that's part of the viceless argument in 1 Corinthians 6:9, in a context in which he's dealing with the incestuous man who is a self-proclaimed Christian. Lotus says that Paul doesn't bring to expression the argument of anatomical and physiological complementarity. Instead, Loder argues a misogyny theory of difference between active and passive roles, but Paul doesn't bring that into expression either. Loder misunderstands the procreation argument. He rejects it because he says Paul doesn't seem all that concerned with the development of progeny when you look at 1 Corinthians 7. But he misses the point about the procreation argument in Paul and in other Jewish theologians, which is simply that there are clues on the basis of that physiological complementarity between man and woman that leads to procreation, that this is designed by God for sex between one another. The context of the Romans 1 text indicates that the conclusions are based on the observation of the things made. That's a nature argument. And when you look at the term phusis elsewhere in Paul, it means the essential material, biological, or organic constitution of things as created by God and set in motion by God. Anatomical and physiological complementarity arguments are also adopted by Greco-Roman moralists and physicians. Hubbard notes this in his source book on homosexuality in Greece and Rome. Basic to the heterosexual position is the characteristic Stoic appeal to the providence of nature, which has matched and fitted the sexes to each other. And others who have written on this issue, Craig Williams on Roman homosexuality, acknowledges a complementarity argument in Roman sources, as does William Shadle, a classicist at the University of Illinois. And then among ancients, Soranus and Philo would lend some support for that theory, as does the pseudo-Lucianic Affairs of the Heart. One nature came together in one bed, but seeing themselves in one another, men with males, they were ashamed neither of what they were doing nor of what they were having done to them. In other words, they should have known that they were too much alike sexually to be engaged in a complementary sexual union with another. Okay, finally, the misogyny argument that this is simply about keeping women down. This is Loder's chief fallback argument. It's basically a difference between active and passive roles. Now, I don't doubt that traditional roles play a part in the overall argument, but it's reductionistic to see it as primary. It ignores concerns for structural compatibility in ancient arguments on this issue. Even Greco-Roman moralist critiques referred to the congruity of the sexes in anatomy and procreation. There are parallel critiques in the ancient world of incest and bestiality as being unnatural on the basis of nature arguments, not on the basis of status arguments. There's an absoluteness of the Bible's prohibition of homosexual practice that suggests a priority of gender over status. Where status concerns dominate over gender in the ancient world, male homosexual practice is accommodated within a broader misogynistic bent, but not where status is not the primary issue, but nature. Women's liberation movements existed in the first century milieu in the Greco-Roman world, and they provided a stimulus for opposing all male homosexual unions, because one of the arguments for man-male homosexual practice is that women are not fit sexual partners for men, because in terms of reason, in terms of control of desires, etc., they're below men. So the appropriate partner for a man sexually is another male, so the argument goes. But it's those who are arguing on behalf of the superiority of man-male love, the heterosexual position, that are the least misogynistic in their argument, precisely because they're arguing that women are suitable companions for men. It's the male homosexual position in these debates that seems in every case to have its origin in a fundamental hatred of women, so Hubbard in his source book. And this leads to the misogyny theory, an absurd corollary. If opposition to homosexual practice is based on misogyny in Scripture, women-hating, then ancient Israel, early Judaism, and early Christianity, which show the greatest opposition to homosexual practice, must then be examples of the greatest misogynists of the day, which is absurd. It's absurd because the view of women in the Bible looks liberating relative to its cultural environment. The creation text posit a husband's rule at the fall. Significant women in the Old Testament are lifted up. Miriam, Tamar, Rahab, Deborah, Ruth, the prophetess Huldah, Esther. Jesus clearly lifts up women in his ministry among his women followers. The statement to Mary and Martha about it being proper for them to sit at his feet and learn from him. About women being recipients of exemplary acts by Jesus to them. And about Jesus' argument about male monogamy, where he argues it's not acceptable anymore for men to have more than one female partner, because if they do, they sin against their wife, which previously was not an argument used, because you weren't sinning against your wife to engage in a polygamous union. But Jesus says, now you are. Paul had women co-workers, Romans 16, a classic example. Mutuality of conjugal rights is expressed by Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. The neither male and female text in Galatians 3:28. And his affirmation of women's prophetic roles in 1 Corinthians. All right, we're going to have to stop there because of time, and we'll continue on to 1 Corinthians 6:9 and other texts. Thank you very much for your patience. It's been good talking to you.